Welcome to Special Sauce, Serious Eats podcast about food and life. Every week on Special Sauce, we talk to some of the leading lights of American culture, food folks and non-food folks alike.
Well, the first time she ever heard the term farm to table, the puzzled look on her face, like, well, how else are they going to do it? I mean, how else are you going to do it? They had it back in her day, too. They called it a flatbed truck.
This week, we are back with the great Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Rick Bragg, the author of The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Kitchen. So first of all, I will tell you that if I wrote a similar book, it might be called The Worst Cook in the World, Tales from My Mother's Totally Uninterested Palate.
Well, my mom didn't like the... She didn't like it. She didn't like the idea. Well, it wasn't that she didn't so much like the idea of telling the stories of her food. She didn't like the ego it would require to call it the best cook in the world. And she said, when I told her, she said, what would you even call it? And I told her the title, and she said, I wasn't even the best cook. It lived on our road. You know, and I said, well, that may be true. But calling it the third best cook on the Royal Webb Road don't sing. So here we are.
You would refer to her as a chef, and she'd say, there aren't any chefs. There are only cooks.
Right, right.
Even though she worked in a restaurant.
She did, but, you know, the word chef, and believe me, I understand the culture and I understand the hierarchy. I mean, they insist on being called chef if they're a chef. You know, and I get it, and I understand the importance. But to her, she went about it with the same blue-collar notion that she went about everything else. And she saw it as the best thing that she could do.
With what she had.
Right. And for people that she loved. It was the best thing she could do with the limited resources she had for the people she loved. Some people sew. Some people kill themselves in a factory. My mama cooked.
Yeah. I think in her own way, she was an insanely proud cook.
Very, you know, she will let slip every now and then some real, almost glee at how things she can do that others can't do. But with her, it really is almost magic. It's almost alchemy. There are no measurements.
I noticed that. Yeah. I was like, how does anyone make these recipes?
Well, believe me, you spend 5 years sitting with your mama begging her to begging her to try to explain it to you. That's the only way to go, you know, to do it. I begged for those recipes. But to her, it was always, how, you know, like, for instance, how much do you use? Like flour. And she'd say, well, you know, enough. Well, how much is enough? Well, you know, a handful, but a good handful. And I would finally figure out that a good handful is a handful and a half. And then you got to transfer that somehow.
Exactly.
You know, but the most irritating thing she would do is she would say, again, after begging, she would say, well, you know, hon, just some. Just some. What? What is some?
Yeah. So this leads me to the question. I mean, this is so much more than a cookbook with the world's longest head notes, which would be one way to describe it. It's really a family cooking history. So how did it come about? Was it a matter of my mom's not getting any younger and I really want to get these recipes and these stories?
It was probably a little sadder than that. What happened was this. We found out about, you know, 4 or 5 years ago that my mom had cancer. And I was, you know, this is the woman who stood between me and every bad thing that ever tried to get me in my life. So I panicked a little bit and I began to, she battled it, and she won. Let's say that right up front. She not only survived a massive surgery, but she survived, you know, woman in her 80s. you know, survived
chemo
two years.
Wow.
You know, that. And she, and right now, she, I guarantee you, she is in her kitchen or in her garden right now. And, but I began to think about what would be lost. But I did not want to imagine a world without my mama in it. So I think a lot of us are like that. And so I knew that I would not do this someday. I would not do this when my mama was gone. I just couldn't bear to do it. I had to do it while she was looking me in the face.
Right.
So but I thought it would be easy. I knew it wouldn't be easy, but I thought it could be doable. I knew we had the stories to tell it as a narrative because, you know, my people can talk. I knew we had the stories. I wasn't sure, you know, we could do the math. We could do all that as we, you know, have talked about. But I really decided that it had to be done. It had to be done quickly. My mom was doing okay, but she was in the hospital and she was weak, and she refuses to wear a hospital gown. She forces doctors to treat her in like a pair of khakis, a jacket, a turtleneck, long handle underwear, and her shoes and two pairs of socks.
Whoa, 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 whoa,
yes,
whoa, whoa.
Yes. In hospital, in regional medical center, she lays in her hospital bed fully clothed, and they just have to, by God, work around her. And because she's not going to wear that rear end out the back hospital gown. It is not, it's just not seemly.
Yeah.
So I have to get her fresh clothes. So this one day, and I'll never forget the smell. I walked into the kitchen, and the kitchen usually smelled like bacon grease or bacon bread. And instead, it smelled like old cold iron. Old cold iron. Iron skillets have, and Dutch ovens have a smell to them. It's a lovely old iron smell,
right,
but it's very much what it is.
Yeah.
Something old, burnt, something old pulled from the fire, and lemon scented dishwashing detergent.
The iron smell you're talking about is, it's unused pans.
Yeah, it's just a clean pan sitting on a hook waiting to.
Yeah, I know exactly that smell you're talking about.
Yeah, and it's not unpleasant.
No,
at all. It's just,
it's not bacon grease.
Yeah, it is what happens when the cook is away. And it occurred to me that I was 58 years old, well, 57 at that time, and I'd never smelled that smell in my mama's kitchen before. So
it probably scared you.
It scared me, and it more than that, it terrified me, and I I've been scared to death a few times in my life. You know, I've had some rocks bounced off my head, and but I've never been that frightened. And I knew then that we needed to do it. We needed to do it expeditiously. We needed to do it where she could hold it in her hands, look at it, and either say that she likes it or throw it at me or something, you know. And
well, sometimes both.
Yeah, and thank goodness she agreed.
Yeah. So what did cooking mean to her? Like what did food mean to her?
Well, everybody likes to think they can do one thing. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody likes to think they can do one thing right. With her, it was always cooking. I never will forget her telling me that, you know, say, you know, your Aunt Jo can dance, you know, and your Aunt Juanita can climb a tree like a man. But I, you know, all I could ever do was cook. And she said that, though not in any kind of self-pitying way, but with a great deal of fierce pride. You know, a cook holds and it's not just my culture. It holds an almost magical place in the eyes of especially working folks. And I've seen it in the Dominican Republic, seen it in Cuba. I mean, seen it in Miami and the Cuban community there, seen it in places all over the world. The cook is a kind of like a high priest of good living.
It was her happy place.
It was. It is, and her kitchen was sanctuary, even if it was 140 degrees.
Yeah.
Her kitchen was sanctuary, and we were not allowed. I mean, I could walk through it. I could walk up to her and say,
but you couldn't hang out with her in the kitchen she was cooking?
We were unclean. We were little country boys, and we were covered head to toe with effluvium. We were covered with tadpoles and coal dust and red mud, and look, we had livestock. So we tracked unspeakable things into her kitchen. And so finally, and she was always, she had been badly burned as a little girl in a hearth. And she was deathly afraid of holding like a skillet or having us around a hot skillet. Because believe me, if chicken was frying, I wanted to be in the proximity,
No lie. Doesn't everyone?
Yeah. So I needed to be there.
Yeah.
And I guess a smart person would say that she had almost this zen-like peace, but she just liked the comfort in her own head that she found.
Yeah.
There.
So what are your favorite bits of her cooking wisdom?
Well, the first one, of course, is nothing good happens in a hurry. Nothing good happens in a hurry. The other is, if you turn your back, it's rent. And not R-U-I-N-E-D, but R-U-R-N-T, rent. Rent is worse than ruined.
Got it.
If you turn your back, it's rent. There are no decent tomatoes in this half of the century, the past century. There are no good tomatoes since probably 1945.
So this is ingredient wisdom.
Right.
That really, she's echoing Alice Waters.
Yeah, there ain't no good tomatoes anymore in this life. Corn is tough now. It didn't used to be. Can't buy a good meal anymore. Flour in the grocery stores usually goes bad before you can get it home to, my favorite is that, hon, pigs are just skinny now. And what she's saying is that there's not a lot of good fat on the pork. Fat is good, and she thinks that pigs are apparently just being starved.
See, if she knew that there was an Edna Lewis in the world
right.
when she was young, she would have found a kindred spirit.
Right.
Because,
right.
Edna was really the first farm-to-table
right.
cook that I ever read about. She's been dead, 10 years, but mm-hmm. was a seminal African-American chef.
Sure.
And sounds like your mother had a great deal in common with Edna
right.
Lewis, but she didn't know her,
right. Well, our food, my mother does know that white folks and black folks of our part of the world and our class ate almost exactly the same thing. Almost exactly the same thing. My mother's potato salad, if I want to get that kind of potato salad, then I have to find it in an African-American community. I have to find it there. It's thinner. When I was in New York, I haunted Harlem. I would
right.
go up and eat.
Yeah, you talk
yeah.
about Sylvia's,
yeah.
And not too many non-uptown people would go to Sylvia's back in the day. Now, of course, there are
oh, yeah.
tour buses
oh, yeah.
and Japanese people.
Yeah.
And
right.
But back when you were in New York,
right.
that was a pretty unusual thing. So you needed that for home.
Oh, I had to. And I would go to great lengths. Try to get a livery cab back 20 years ago and I'd do anything to get up there. And it was always the same thing. It was smoked turkey wings, cornbread dressing, green beans or greens. And if I was really feeling peckish, there would be caramel cake.
tell us what your version of caramel cake is.
Well, it's yellow cake. Yellow cake. Now, some people do use white, but yellow cake usually. And just an icing made out. It's a sugar icing, basically, but a caramel, homemade caramel
icing.
Right, and
it could be, at the best soul food restaurants, it has, the icing is very smooth. It's not grainy at all.
No, it's not grainy at all. But even the worst caramel cake you ever had is pretty good. So it's like the worst sausage gravy you ever had is probably still pretty good.
Yes, for sure.
I spent a great bit of my paycheck up there and loved every second of it.
And I loved your take on and your mother's take on the fact that we've talked a little bit about it before, about that Southern traditions, food traditions are changing.
Yeah.
Southern food culture is alive,
right,
and it's multicultural in the best possible way.
Right.
What do you think your mother makes of that?
Well, the first time she ever heard the term farm to table, the puzzled look on her face, like, well, how else are they going to do it? I mean, how else are you going to do it? They had it back in her day, too. They called it a flatbed truck. You know, there wasn't. I mean, our farm to table might just mean walking, you know, from the garden with a bushel basket full of the best tomatoes in the world. Back, of course, 50 years ago,
right,
when you could still get one.
Sure.
She gets mad sometimes at the food channels. You know, she gets a little mad at them when they like are making like a tofu hoe cake or,
right,
you know, something like that.
Sure.
And that just makes her actually feel bad.
Right.
Because it's just, you know, to her, it's just unnatural.
Sure. But what about the real food from other cultures that she's now surrounded by?
Oh, well, for instance, she loves a good greasy lasagna, you know, a good,
right,
dripping,
sure,
lasagna. And she likes her spaghetti to be the decadent kind, you know. If she doesn't eat a lot of pizza, but if she does eat pizza, she wants it smothered in bad things for her.
Can she get to tacos or?
Best night of my life recently. I'm not making this up. Now, this may speak to how dull my life is, but best night of my life. I took my mama down to Fairhope, Alabama. I have an old house down there near Mobile Bay. And I said, why don't we go in the Mexican restaurant? And she said, I don't know. You know, the only taco she'd ever had was from a drive-through window. And she said, I don't know. And so she was reluctant anyway. But there is a fine Mexican restaurant down there. And I finally talked her into walking in. We got sat down, and I hear a trumpet blare. And all of a sudden, a full-blown mariachi band starts moving through the restaurant. I thought, oh, you know, God, you know, she's not going to enjoy it. She's going to be embarrassed somehow, you know. And instead, she fell in love with the music. She fell in love with I think they did a version of I'll Fly Away in Spanish, and it was beautiful. And she loved the guitar, and she loved it. But mostly she loved the guacamole.
That's so great.
Now, unfortunately, now she says, hey, you know, I'll say, where do you want to go eat lunch? She'll say, hey, let's go get us some of that locomotive. And I say, what? And she says, you know, that locomotive, you know, they make it out of them things. And I say, do you mean guacamole? So
excellent.
She calls it locomotive.
So one thing, the book has a unique format because there's a narrative that ends with a recipe.
Mm-hmm.
And the narrative falls through and it's chronological.
Right.
Was that your idea in the first place or is that just how it came together?
That's just how it came together. Now, once I figured out how to do it, the way to do it was to abandon trying to say we're going to have all these recipes. And making a list of recipes, that was going to fail. So what I did was this. I did what we know best. I went with the stories. And for instance, the story of how we got our food from my great-grandfather to my grandmother, I knew that had to be the Genesis.
Got it.
And I knew that continuing that for several chapters would be worthwhile. So what I have to try to find out is, from my mom, is, do you remember the first thing that he taught my grandma? And, you know, thank God we date from food. You know, we date from food mm-hmm. the way some people date from the death of Elvis.
Sure.
You know, and we know that the first thing he taught her was butter rolls because she cooked the main course. And that led to, of course he taught her beans.
Right.
So I could use beans anywhere in the
Got
next
it.
Chapter. Of course he taught her, you know, how the ham was mixed into that. Of course he taught
her. So it sort of organized itself.
Yeah. I mean, you know, of course he taught her a good breakfast.
Right.
So that was really chronologically falling off a log.
Yeah.
Now, and later, when my mother's own memory took over, it really got easy.
Got it.
But I did have to leave out some recipes of some really good food because I didn't have a story.
Interesting. You don't really cook, do you? I mean, I'm sorry. I got to call like
yeah,
I see it.
Yeah, I can cook about, there's 70-something recipes in this thing. I can cook maybe, following the recipes, I can think
right.
I could make a stab at all of them. But I can cook four things. I can make good pinto beans and ham.
Okay.
Which is really just putting an awful lot of ham fat and the bone
right.
into
making sure the beans are cooked all
right,
the way through.
And, you know, and maybe a tiny little bit of sugar, maybe a small onion just for flavor, like almost no bigger than a pearl onion. Or it'll overpower. No garlic because it'll overpower. So I can make good sausage gravy, but I can't do a biscuit. So what good is it?
Right.
You know, unless you can run out to the Popeyes and like bootleg some biscuits
right.
into the house.
Yeah, yeah.
So I am I'm a miserable cook.
But you're a serious eater. We appreciate that here.
Yeah, I love to eat. And, you know, people asked over and over again, did you use a test kitchen?
Yes, well, I was going to ask that.
Yeah, and of course I used a test kitchen. I'm 6'2". I weigh 230 pounds. I am a test kitchen. I am a walking, breathing test kitchen.
Okay, fair enough. Does she still cook for you?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Yeah, pinto beans and ham. She has cooked Thanksgiving dinner since she got sick, and I mean, she might need a little help getting the turkey in the oven.
Yeah.
You know, and this is a true story. In my county, if you have trouble getting your turkey into my county in Alabama, if you cannot get your turkey into your oven on Thanksgiving, you can call the rescue squad. And they will come out and help you.
Yes, you mentioned that in the book.
Yeah.
And then you also mentioned the fact that you bought... you were sent to buy the turkey one dinner, and then you decided you had to get a ride on the horse outside the supermarket, and the turkey ran away.
That might be as kindly put as I could have ever heard it. Thank you.
I tried to be, you know, charitable.
Well, there's no reason in, you know, locking somebody in this little room and then beating them up. What happened was I had one job. Everybody else had a lot of jobs during the holidays. You know, they had to procure trees. They had to blow mistletoe out of the trees with a shotgun. They had to, you know, they had to buy presents and wrap presents. Well, I wasn't trusted with anything like that because I was considered, when I was 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, simple-minded. So I was turkey boy. My job was to carry the turkey from either the Piggly Wiggly or the A&P, carry it to the car. That was the only job I had.
Not so hard.
No. I mean, right? Anybody can do it. But there's this Rocky horse, you know, those coin-operated Rocky horses. Well, look, you're a kid, and you got a pocket full of nickels, and
And you can figure out a way to hold on to the turkey when you're on the horse.
Let's just say I lost track of time. I was moving a little too quick, and there's not a good handle on those things. You know, now they put them in a net
right.
thing. But, you know, I had both arms wrapped around it, and it just kind of squirted up. I was being so careful not to have it fall through the bottom. I wasn't paying attention to the top.
So it was expelled.
Yeah. And it took a pretty good ride through that parking lot before I ran it down.
You said that there were two hills.
Yeah, it was. It didn't have one slope. It had two slopes.
All right. Now it's time for the special sauce all-you-can-answer buffet.
Okay.
So who's at your last supper? No family allowed. Like, just people you think would be great to have. You don't have to know them, obviously.
I'm not going to think too hard about this, or we'd be sitting here all day. Galileo.
All right.
Galileo wrote in Italian instead of writing in Latin so that his work could be read and used.
And acted upon.
And acted upon by more than just the elite.
Got it. All right,
and,
I like
and,
that.
And if that's not a by God reason, and he suffered for it, he was forced to recant, but I forgave him for that, you know. I've always thought that Lincoln would have a hell of a story to tell if there wasn't anybody, if he didn't have to worry about what he said.
Yeah.
You know, and like every other politician, he had to worry about what he said.
I like that. Lincoln and Galileo.
You know, so if he, I did a book on Jerry Lee Lewis, and, Jerry Lee is still with us, but he is supposed to have died many times now. So
you got to have Jerry Lee.
Yeah, Jerry Lee.
And one more.
Just to hear the story again of him making Elvis cry.
All right.
I know this is hokey, but, my grandfather died the spring before the summer I was born. And he was a gigantic figure in my part of the woods. He made whiskey in the mountains for 30 years. He did time in federal prison one time.
You know that I am going to let you, Rick Bragg, be the only person to include a member of your family. Because it sounds like...
Oh, that's how smart I am.
That's okay. So what are you eating?
Well, I had some really good Greek food for lunch.
All right.
Look, I can destroy a Chinese buffet. I can destroy a Chinese buffet. I love the grazing part of a Mexican restaurant. You know, I lived in L.A. for a while, so I had some really fine.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but as far as I'm concerned, pico de gallo, I could eat
on a
shoe tongue.
Yeah.
You know, no problem. Hard to get, my great disappointment in life, in this part of my life, is the slow decline of fried chicken. There are still great mom-and-pop places with great fried chicken.
Yeah, so we'll just make sure that they're cooking the fried chicken.
Yeah, yeah.
So you got to have fried chicken. And it sounds to me, given how much you've written about pie, that pie has to be the dessert.
I almost killed myself with pie. I mean, I almost did my life in with pie. Not the whole damn pie, but a child should not be allowed to eat more than a quarter slice a pecan pie. I think it's like heart would be really bad for their health. I put myself into some kind of like LSD like coma or trip.
You did? Like what happened? You just ate an entire.
I ate too much sugar. It was a pecan pie. It was still warm. My mother said, "Wait, we'll cut it later." I stole it, and I didn't steal the whole thing, but I stole most of it. And I sat and I ate it, and I ate it gleefully and joyfully. And then, you know how children get hyper? I got loopy and staggered around. So, I shouldn't be allowed near pie.
Yeah, I'm the same way. I have the same predilection for pie. And I've taken to buying the little pies.
Yeah, I get them. Yeah.
Because that way I'm not going to go through an entire pie.
Yeah. Yeah, but then if you eat four.
Yes, that's true. That's true. So give me three books that have profoundly influenced your life as a writer and as a person.
Sure. To Kill a Mockingbird put into song almost, into story, the feelings that a lot of us already had mm-hmm. about, I was born in 59, I grew up in the 1960s. In this beautiful sermon, this beautiful kind of morality play, but mostly just this beautiful story, this beautifully written story.
And it was poetry.
It was poetry. And even though I have disagreed with some parts of it, I think that when Southern writers take us and they kind of make the upper classes, the lawyer class, the old money class, when they make them always the hero, the enlightened
mm-hmm.
South.
Right.
And the villains are always the poor folks that live on the way to the dump. My only disagreement with that book was that she fell to that.
Mm-hmm.
She
interesting.
You know, and but that said,
yeah,
it was
sure.
still the most. I remember reading a faded paperback copy.
And now it's going to be a play that Aaron Sorkin
really?
Is writing. Yeah.
Well, good.
And there was a fight about with the estate about whether they had permission
right.
and what whether he was
right.
taking too much license, but it's been settled.
Not well.
It's coming to Broadway.
Yeah.
All right. So there's one.
I know that Moby Dick, the passage where Ahab drives the gold sovereign into the mast post and gives his impassioned sermon on the lengths that he is willing to go to kill this thing, is some of the best writing I think mm-hmm. I've ever read. Pretty much anything by Thomas Wolfe. Pretty much anything, you know.
Yeah.
The relationship, I was just talking with my editor, Jordan Pavlin at Knopf, about the relationship with that he had with Perkins, you know, Max Perkins.
Yeah.
I guess if I was going to pick a book, Larry McMurtry's Lonesome Dove.
That's a great book.
Right.
That
I think
it's a great book.
You know, people always say Desert Island. They always use that. You know?
Right.
I was marooned in Clearwater, Florida, with no books and no TV and not even any radio. But I had a paperback copy of Lonesome Dove, and I read it two times back to back. And the love affair, because that's what it is, between Gus McRae and Woodrow Call, the love of a friend,
yeah,
that you feel come out. You know, like just hard as steel and soft as the air.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that's just one of my favorites.
It's just been declared Rick Bragg Day all over the world.
Really?
What's happening on that day?
Well, probably a whole lot of people will not bother to show up for work. Probably they will sell out of deli fried chicken. All over the world, you
this.
Know. More than likely, they'll sell out at the. They'll probably sell out at the Target or the Walmart in that $5 rack of copies of Sam Cooke and Hank Williams, you know.
I like that, and so you'll be listening. Everyone will be listening to Sam Cooke, which is pretty awesome.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah, maybe Jimmie Rogers.
Jimmie Rogers, my mama. You know, still thinks Jimmie Rogers is poetry.
Yeah, he's great.
You know, and Hank, and probably could wear out some Earl Haggard. But I've always been a big rhythm and blues.
Yeah,
and
me blues too. Fan. Sam Cooke is, you know, to me, it's stone cold genius.
If you could sing like Sam Cooke, you would just sit in the middle of a field.
That's what you do on Rick Bragg.
And you'd sing to the sky.
Yeah,
right.
And everyone would hear it because the vibrations would be so powerful.
Absolutely.
So, thank you so much for sharing your special sauce with us, Rick Bragg. Please, it was such an honor to have you here.
Heck, really. This is easy.
Do yourself a favor and read The Best Cook in the World, Tales from My Mama's Table. Even if you don't cook from it, it's an awesome read. Or you can read All Over But the Shoutin' or any of Rick's books, because they're all terrific. So, thanks again, Rick, and so long, Sirius Theaters. We'll see you next time.
All right.